Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Monday, April 13th. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by Tim Priester and Drew Mentock of Irish Illustrated. We are 5 days away from what we believe will be the most important practice viewing of the spring. And actually, I guess, Tim Priester, the most important practice viewing of the 2026 college football season, because they should show us more in what we have dubbed and believe to be the Jersey scrimmage coming up this Saturday. And of course, the rest of the world can watch either delay on Peacock or live the Blue Gold game on April 25th. So we have a good 7 day period there where we'll see a lot of football and can put to rest some speculation we've had all spring.
Yeah, the scrimmage before the week before the Blue Gold game is generally more enlightening. You see units playing together more than you will necessarily in the Blue Gold game. And you know, I think with a crowd in the stands, it's a little bit more guarded on Blue Gold game day. It is the media, though we can report it, I guess, from the previous Saturday. But yeah, I mean, generally speaking, we find that to be the most telling. We talked about this recently, some of the passes that CJ Carr threw in the Jersey scrimmage in a couple years ago were quite telling as to what he was capable of doing.
Right. No, exactly. And I think, yeah, it's usually, as you said, a lot more competitive. I think the guys playing with each other is key, because what if Anthony Knapp and Will Black aren't lining up next to each other in the Blue Gold game? Like, what does it really matter? Because they might miss an assignment because they expect somebody to be doing something they should or something like that. So I think those are really key in the Blue Gold game. Like, you can still see maybe individual flashes, or especially the receivers making plays, but they're going to dial back the defense often too, stuff like that. They're not going to show as much. So the Jersey scrimmage, at least under Marcus Freeman, since I have been covering the team, has been more important, and they try and keep that as competitive as possible too.
It's a good point about skill position guys, though, because Tim, I remember we saw very young Mitchell Evans make a catch down the post in the Blue Gold game. We're like, oh, I didn't know he could do that. And then, of course, he became as adept at doing that as any tight end in the last 8 years for Notre Dame. He was great at that. I still hold on to Nolan James breaking tackles. Now, the problem in the Blue Gold game last year, the problem is I can't remember whose tackles he was breaking, and I'm guessing that was part of it. But, you know, we believe Nolan James to be a guy that will break tackles here as in a starring role or a 1B role for Notre Dame. That, so you do get some stuff. We also, if you want to put a finer point on it, we all like what we hear about Matty Augustine right now, right? You watch the Blue Gold game only last year, you'd think he has no idea what he's doing in a uniform. And that has nothing to do with what Matty Augustine is. So it can be misleading. Right. It's something you got to process.
Yeah, and there are so many receivers now that we're very eager to see in a scrimmage setting, that it's too bad Quincy Porter isn't out there. But a chance to see Mylon Graham live, a chance to see Bubba Frazier, who we've heard good things about, a chance to see Cam Williams, who flashed in a non-padded practice to start spring. You know,
Burris, who we talk about.
Burris, too, who I talked about. Yeah, right. No, I think Burris looks a lot more, in the brief glimpse that we had, I thought he looked a lot more comfortable and certain about what route he was running and what he was doing on the field.
Yeah, and I think you definitely see guys flash the Blue Gold game. I mean, two of the plays that stick out in my mind from last year's game, I think Carson Hobbs had that kind of pickup tackle on Kedron Young, and then Ben Minnick picked off CJ Carr. And those are like two plays that really stick out to me. And obviously those guys didn't really end up working out too well either. So you can see things in that game, especially with the things change, that maybe don't mean that much.
That might be a Monday music column for preview Blue Gold game. The names of the Blue Gold game that were talked about on the Saturday after the Blue Gold game that showed up and didn't. Because one, Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah was a guy that was talked about after Blue Gold game. Also, how good of a game Low Wood had. So these things are always have to be parsed out, as I said. You guys had a chance, and I read the transcripts, to speak with Aaron Henry and Marty Biagi. I'm surprised Javad Coughlin has not come out to speak, since he is the new safeties coach. Maybe that will happen during the season. You know, Biagi is kind of helps out with the defensive backs last year and is doing so this year. Aaron Henry, he's a good storyteller, that's for sure. He's a fun guy to talk to when he goes and talks about his defensive backs.
Go ahead, Drew.
Yeah, I mean, he's it's hard to get too many questions in with him, but he does give you great detail on the questions he does ask. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, he talked a lot about needing to humble this group. I think even us, like, I mean, I will say it's either them or probably Alabama is the best secondary in the country next year. So I talked to TP a little bit about this, too, is that, like, I feel like they had to do this a little bit with Jeremiah Love this time last year and over the summer, where he was talking about, I want to be the first running back to win the Heisman, and getting a little bit personal with what he wanted to do, and I think they kind of started that process, and by the time we got out round of the season. Maybe he was a little more candid in other ways when we talked to him come August, but he wasn't as me focused. He was all about the team and doing whatever he could. And I think that process is starting with some of these defensive backs, especially like Don Shuler, Tay Johnson, and of course, Leonard Moore.
I just wonder how, I'm not saying that Aaron Henry doesn't play well, doesn't work well with the group in meetings, but he's wound tight. I mean, he's a different personality, and he's going to come in and express his opinion and motivate in his way, which is generally a lot of words and a lot of emotion. And so I just wonder how that plays. But he's working with a good group of guys, and I did a feature on Leonard Moore today and used some of, because what's the challenge for Leonard Moore? I mean, staying humble maybe is his greatest challenge, because everything has come so well and so easily for him. And so, Aaron Henry is doing that. He says, young guys need to give them direction. And that's really important. And, even at this level and at that age, complacency can set in real, real easily. So Aaron Henry is making sure that that won't happen, at least during the spring. And this is an extremely talented group with a level of depth that we generally don't see.
I like Henry's approach, because corner will humble you in a hurry. At some point, you're going to get humbled at corner. If it happens to Leonard Moore because he's matched up against Malachi Toney to make the score 7-7, that's a really bad time for Leonard Moore to be humbled. If it happens against Purdue because someone beats him, that's a fine situation. Leonard Moore can bounce back from that. Tim, you remember in 1993, Bobby Taylor had one of the best years you've ever seen, putting a corner on the other team's best receiver all the way through the season. He goes in the BC game with a little bit of an ankle injury and gets shredded by a guy named Clarence Cannon, and that's the famous loss.
Ooh, I didn't even remember his name.
It happens at corner. Leonard Moore's biggest mistake was a touchdown by Miami on the highlight reel touchdown of the year for the Hurricanes in the end zone to end the half. He knows, if you went back and asked, that was almost stranger than a Don Shuler on the same play. It was the same play. If you ask Leonard Moore 50 times, like, I don't know why I would jump a route that's just going to end the half if he catches it. They would have to kick a field goal. He jumped that route. There's always something out there. I think that's good for Henry's approach. It's hard to come in and just tell everybody how great they are. I mean, he's got to come in and challenge them in some other way. Look, and I think Mickens does. We wouldn't be asking those questions of Mickens.
If you've ever been an athlete and been in live competition, it doesn't matter how many years you play. The first game of the year is different than every other game. Yeah. You can't immediately find a comfort zone. That was the end of the first half, so maybe you should say you should have found a comfort zone at that point. But you're on the road. It's a hostile environment. It happens, and it happens in every sport. No matter how many years you play, the first game of the year is different than the other ones. You're just not back into that groove and that mindset that you'll have later in the season.
With Henry, too, I think I talked to Luke Talich a lot during the interviews, and he talked about how, like, Mike Mickens kind of made you have that killer mentality, and I think that's kind of his approach all the time, whereas I think Henry's a little more, he has a lot of different sides to him. He's like a preacher almost. He's like a lot more buddy-buddy and friendly, and then he says he has unique ways to humble them, but I don't feel like he really went into what those unique ways are. So we just don't know. We know what Mike Mickens could get out of cornerbacks, and we've seen some of what Aaron Henry can do at Illinois, but he has a much different approach compared to what we're used to. And we just don't know how it's going to work. Cause again, the only thing that probably could screw up the secondary other than injuries is they just get too full of themselves. And that's probably his biggest challenge.
Plenty of nickel talk with Christian Gray. Unfortunately, I believe Dallas Golden missed because he's nursing an injury. So Dallas Golden wasn't there to talk nickel competition and all the things that go into it. And of course, I maintain you'll see Leonard Moore in that spot in certain situations. But a lot from Christian Gray. I thought the most telling was when he said, I'm going to play both, but it does seem like I'm nickel now. In other words, he is really learning nickel. The plan is for nickel, and he can always rotate out to the field, because Christian Gray's played field corner at a high level for a couple of years. And Tim, remember, he still knows boundary if they need a backup ever situation for Moore. He started out at boundary, then he moved as a sophomore.
He kind of talked about nickel twice in his interview the other day, initially, and then when I came up and talked to him and didn't know what he had already already talked about. I asked him we mentioned this when Drew and I did the incident analysis the other day, Freeman was the one that first approached him about it. And And Tim, I know that you have skepticism about him playing there, but let me just say this, like, in defense of the move. I think, like, how would you rather have Christian Gray playing on instinct, press coverage, man up at the, you know, head up with the receiver on the line of scrimmage and react? Or do you want him backpedaling and thinking about the route and deciphering? I mean, I think maybe, you know, the mentality of the nickel position, I think maybe fits him better. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, mine isn't about the move. It's Christian Gray, with his injuries, holding up, tackling people all year at the line of scrimmage on screen passes. And the nickel's a violent, violent spot. They lost Devontae Smith to its violence. They lost Tariq Bracey at times to its violence. Thomas Harper missed a game with it. I just feel like it's a hard position for him to play. I'm not saying they didn't do the right thing. When he's on the field and he has to play, how will he do? That's all I'm saying. I'm not questioning any decision that Mike Mickens made. It was Mike Mickens that made it, and Marcus Freeman.
And he was strongly influenced by, it's my understanding that he had conversations with some people in the NFL who thought that Gray was a good fit for nickel. Drew, what are your thoughts on the Gray at nickel?
I kind of agree with T.O. We've seen him kind of miss some open field tackles where he just didn't look like he had that toughness. And this is a position where you're in the box more. They're going to ask you to blitz and do things like that. And those are things maybe I'm less certain that he'll be able to do. I think he can probably get the adjusted route trees and he's quick enough to be good in space and all those things. But I'm kind of curious how he adapts those things. But it could be we want him to try and cover Malachi Toney or something in Miami. Maybe it's a, you know, certain games he makes more sense for certain matchups.
And I'm not saying Christian Gray is going to be good at nickel. I don't know any more than you do.
I'm trying to find out if my evaluation is I don't know if he can hold up and play nickel for 15 games.
Okay. All right. I don't know that we've actually discussed that aspect.
Yeah.
He's
hurt his shoulders. He's played a lot of snaps, but he'll play if he plays 200 less snaps because he plays 350 at nickel and 150 at corner. He'll probably be healthier and be a more valuable player. He was always dragging, like the USC game. He was clearly injured, playing injured against good receivers.
Yeah, no doubt. And we have a question in the second segment about a pairing, you know, with Dallas Golden. I mean, I think that's a pretty good replacement. I think you feel pretty comfortable about him.
And you don't
sharing
want
that spot
playing 500 snaps at nickel either.
Right.
Because he's a 19-year-old as opposed
right,
to
exactly.
Yeah, the
exactly.
rugged
22-year-old. And I do wonder just they maybe don't know entirely what they're going to get out of DJ McKinney. So maybe they want to be prepared with some flexibility now. Maybe McKinney's a guy they don't feel like can do nickel at all. So they just want to have some options because a potential key piece isn't on campus. And while they can watch film and talk to him a little bit, they don't really know what he's like in the practice field.
I have a full breakdown. I meant to do it last week for Monday Musings. It's going to this one of DJ McKinney's 2-year stats and Christian Gray's 2-year stats in every in both positions. They haven't played much slot, so it's really one position. But you know what they've done and the major difference. Since we're not going to run through stats on a podcast, the major difference is Christian Gray clutches and grabs too much and gets called for it. His penalties are off the charts.
You had an interference total on McKinney?
Yeah, I have interference totals on McKinney. Okay. Christian Gray made more plays on the ball, more interceptions, more touchdowns. Their coverage percentage is exactly the same, targets versus receptions. So anybody says they're getting an upgrade at that, it's DJ McKinney doesn't clutch and grab, and those are 15 yards. So that does matter. Now, that doesn't get baked in, right? That gets baked in.
Now, clutch and grab is good at times, but if it's done too often, it's...
Yeah, and I think Gray might have a reputation for it. He's a pretty famous dude going to games now. Like Christian, when people are going to look at Christian Gray this year, they'll be like, that guy is still at Notre Dame. You know how you do that when
it's true.
To your point, refs watch film. So if he has a history of doing it, they're going to be more likely to see it and potentially call it because they're going to be looking for it more than they might for other players. So that I think over time, those reputations. Now, I don't know if they go back to last year's film, but I think that does play into how he's called a little bit.
You guys had a chance to talk with Luke Talich, and he had the awkward moments of having to discuss the Jaugesse injury because he brought his friend out for a fun summer junket to see his family along with other friends on the Notre Dame football team. That's a rough situation for Luke Talich. But we'll get on to Luke Talich and what he brings to the Notre Dame football team. But that was kind of a tough situation for him to discuss the Jogusa thing, and he had to ask questions. Jogusa, see, another one.
Jogusa, yes, it's ooh. What his
had a
latest
very delicate commentary about how many name pronunciations he has had in his career at Notre Dame.
Jogusa, that's easier than saying Jogusa.
That is easier, but we've had to Drew, say that for some reason.
Yeah, Drew, were you with Talich? Did you spend any time?
Yeah, I was there the whole time, so okay, I was great. There for the. For all those specific questions, I thought Luke handled it well. Like, I mean, he mentioned that Coach Freeman's like, we were all hanging out together. We had time off, and it wasn't just Jagusa and Jordan Faison. It was, who's his good friend and former walk-on. It was 10 guys out there camping and doing a bunch of stuff, and a freak incident happened. And he did say like, it probably just changed my perspective on if I'm going to ride a UTV or something. And I don't know if we'll bring guys out again next year, but I think he answered the questions and he went through it well, and it's a really unfortunate situation, and it sucks because my dad's from Cody, Wyoming, and 4th of July is a great time to be out there, so it's unfortunate for them too that their good time going to rodeos and stuff was obviously sidetracked significantly by that injury.
Well, the real significant stuff was what Drew talked about on the incident analysis the other day about Talich playing some outside linebacker, which I wasn't aware that was happening. You want to talk about that a little bit?
The goal line. It kind of did at the goal line last
year.
Yeah,
and he's got his weight up. He's up to like 224, 225 now, so he's kind of built more like a linebacker, and I think the coaches see that a little bit. And I think that was his plan, too, in this offseason. It's the first real full offseason he's had at Notre Dame, too. So he's kind of put on that size, and he was really good in coverage last year. You look at his Pro Football Focus numbers, like his passer rating was the best on the team amongst guys with at least 100 coverage snaps. So he does that. He's working on some pass rush stuff. He kind of can take on a little bit of that KVA role, I think, is the plan. So we'll see kind of how that progresses and if that's something they use him for. But he's like, yeah, I'm doing a little bit of Sam linebacker. And he's a really unique body type. I mean, he's 6'4", 225. Like that is the type of guy who could do a lot of different things. And we're talking about nickel. He spent time with Coach Andy Boo, who's kind of their nickel coach right now too. So he's working with a bunch of different guys, even talking to Coach Partridge about his stances and stuff off the edge. So it'll be interesting if he kind of, you know, he is that third safety right now with the other two back, but there's some unique ways they can probably use him this year.
I think as important, Tim, as he's the third safety, if he can play those other roles, they love Ethan Long and everybody loves Joey right. O'Brien. You could work another guy in there. That it's the depth of talent and the way to use them.
Yeah. I don't know that Joey O'Brien is ready physically. I think he needs to fill out a little bit more, but Ethan Long is a little bit different. Really good athlete. It was mentioned the other day about, you know, having to get into the playbook. So there's some things that aren't completely clear in his mind, but athletically, you know, he has what it takes, whether they're ready to, you know, employ Talich more up near the line of scrimmage and then freely insert Ethan Long into the equation. I'm not sure that they're there yet, but he sure looks the part. Not quite as much as the part that when Tay Johnson walked up the steps the other day, I'm like, that's the skinny kid I saw playing at Fort Wayne High School football. He's an imposing dude. Yeah, on the football field now.
He's confident, too. I enjoyed his interview. He is. He just knows. He's like, yeah, everybody has roles on the team, and mine is to create big plays. It's just you can't just say my role is going to be to create big plays. You have to be capable of doing those things.
You can do it.
Like, you're just not going to have, you know, random guy come in and say, yeah, I'm going to be the big play. Jaden, I'm going to be the big playmaker. Other guys will do other stuff. No, he is a knack for it. I will always hold him up as the – everybody told us he was going to be good. We all believed everybody. They all said he might end up starting by the end of the year last April. Remember, like, yeah, I think he'll work his way in. You know, he might be able to beat out Stroman. He was a top 10 player on Notre Dame's football team. Like, that was a huge, not a wasted moment because it's going to lean into this one, but that's the type of thing that drives you through playoff runs when you have Tay Johnson appears to be.
Yeah, there. Well, it was just, you know, with Kyle Hamilton, we had a forewarning.
Yeah. We did. It was August 1st. Hey, guys.
Right. Like, we had, you know, some foreshadowing, so to speak. But we didn't see it. I didn't see it on the practice field. And he looks the part.
Even when you saw it on the practice field, that first practice, everybody's like, I mean, it's not Kyle Hamilton.
I mean, it's Carr just trying, you know, throwing deep. And he, yeah, exactly right.
We have 9 football questions for segment 2, burning up the boards, but there was a little bit of Notre Dame news in the transfer portal. As you would imagine, it was not the good kind. Cole Cirta has greener pastures. He will head to Clemson. I saw a lot of angst on the board saying, now we're losing players to Clemson. You guys know how much better Clemson has been than Notre Dame?
Clemson's way better. They're way better than Notre Dame.
I just want to make sure everyone's on the same page here. Cole Cirta, I mean, we knew these three guys have been leaving for a long time, but it's a tough one because he's a guy that certainly would have developed in the pre-transfer portal era under Mike Bray to be a top 15 Notre Dame scorer of all time, Tim Priester type thing. Would you consider how much he plays in those early years?
I mean, they call quarterbacks gunslingers. This guy's got a gunslinger mentality that he wants to let it fly when he gets hot. You know, we saw him score in the 30s, what, 3 times this past season.
That's different.
That's significant. That kind of stuff just doesn't happen every day on the collegiate level now. I saw Austin Carr score 38 and a half. So, I mean, that just doesn't happen anymore. But, Clemson, I didn't expect it. You can certainly understand why Clemson would have a need for that because they're always defense first. They're always defensively very sound, and they need a spark offensively. And I'm sure they paid him handsomely to fill that role.
Yeah, I agree with you, Tio. I'm almost of those three, you know, guards that we knew were going to go in. He's kind of the one I wish I would have gotten to see more of over time, just because some of the things he could do really stood out. I mean, it got to the point where, I mean, he still had some bad misses when he'd pull up from near the logo, but you're also like, oh, this might go in. And there's some exciting things, and I liked the way he moved on the court, and I think it would have been interesting to see him develop at Notre Dame maybe differently than the other two. But, yeah, it's tough because there's a good chance they might have to play him now too. So it's an addition to an opponent as well as a subtraction from Notre Dame.
50 more wins and 5 NCAA tournament appearances over the last 9 years for Clemson, Notre Dame with 1 NCAA tournament appearance, of course. And I'm going back to when Bonzi, now I included this year because they were good and they kind of got jobbed, but Bonzi, that's the last year Bonzi Colson and Matt Farrell when Bonzi was hurt. Clemson's been good for a while. And
now Brad Brunell has done a really, really good job there. It's always been defense first, and kind of like what Tony Bennett had to deal with at times, that, you know, when they lose, you say, you know, they don't have enough offense, too much emphasis on the defensive side of the ball. Of course, Tony Bennett won a national title, and I'm not sure that Brad Brunell is going to do that anytime soon, but they're a threat. I mean, they are a Sweet 16, Elite 8 threat on a yearly basis now because they are so good defensively.
Final question here. A question here leading into our question segment from Kay Beasley, a men's lacrosse question, which he wants us to check out other Notre Dame sports. Obviously, men's lacrosse, back-to-back wins over the number one team in the country in Richmond and North Carolina. Of course, the North Carolina one everybody was aware of, but back-to-back wins. Is it the first time it's been done in a major college sport at Notre Dame? I could not find another. What was the back-to-back? Because, you know, there's nothing in between. Lacrosse lends itself to that as opposed to baseball cannot, because you would have to play a series and then go play another series against the team that's elected number one. And in basketball, it's just really hard to do. But what's the closest performance to that in the modern era of football? And he referenced in 88, they beat number one Miami, and then he wrote USC and West Virginia. It was 1, 2, and 3, actually. Those teams were 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah. That's pretty incredible. Well, it's a good segue from Clemson basketball defense, because Notre Dame men's lacrosse is doing it with defense first. They're one of the best defensive lacrosse teams in the country. They win faceoffs. I'm looking for the gentleman's name Sean Light is one of the defenders and has been a mainstay since he was a freshman. And Josh Iago and Luke Miller have become the goal scorers. Tyler Spano is the guy that has become the face-off king for Notre Dame. And so I don't follow it as closely, but I'm told there isn't necessarily a super one or two teams in college lacrosse, which obviously is a very limited number, but when you play the great defense that Notre Dame does, they're a threat every time they go out, and Kevin Corrigan's doing it again.
Yeah, I think it's impressive, too. There's no Kavanaughs around anymore. They lost Jordan Faison because now he's focused on football. So it's kind of after that really great era, now it is a lot of new guys. You know, they don't have, blanking on the goalie's name, ETN back there anymore. Obviously, he left 2 years ago. So they've that really great run they've had, a lot of those key players are gone, and they've kind of reloaded with different players. So it's really impressive what they've built. And obviously, they use some of those national championships to recruit well, too. But he's showing a lot of sustainability right now.
Put a finer point on the question, and I think this is worthy. So Notre Dame ended 88, they were number one. So you can't beat number one when you're number one. So let's be fair to this situation. They beat number two, USC at USC. They beat number three, West Virginia, for the national title, undefeated West Virginia. The only reason they were at number two is because Notre Dame had beaten Miami, who moved down to number two. So they already handled that. Starting the next year, although there was a kickoff classic game in between, they then went out to Michigan and beat number two, Michigan, when they were ranked number one. So you could not beat number one because you were number one. I think beating 1, 2, 3, and 2 when you were number one. Yes.
What year was that? What year was that?
And that's all you're going to get, right, Drew?
88 going into 89.
Oh, yeah.
88 going into 89,
yeah. Also, I went back way far, and I went to, I think it's 1943. They were number one most of the year, and they beat number three Navy, number three Army, number eight Northwestern, number two Iowa pre-flight, which I think is Iowa State or Iowa. I'm not sure. And they were number one. So, again, to your point, they couldn't beat themselves, but they had a four game stretch where they beat the number three, number three, number eight, number two.
In the Iowa pre-flight game, that is when Pete Sampson picked Iowa pre-flight to beat Notre Dame in the in the bowl game. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question is going to be a long one, but it's a great one. From CMU Pens fan, new to the show, if position by position you had to rank the quality and depth of the 2026 team versus the 2024 team, who would have the advantages and why? This is tough because starters are more important, but let's focus also on depth, guys. Starting with quarterback, Drew Mentok, we know the depth answer, but how do you rank quarterback 26 versus 24?
Yeah, to what you just said, it's tough. I went 2026 just because of what the ceiling for the starter is. And I mean, even if Steve Angeli had started that, had come in late, and he was much better backup than anything that we project them to have right now on this year's team, but he's not leading them to the title game, most likely. I know he came in against Penn State, but that was without a lot of film on him and stuff. So I still would go with the high-end guy, and you just got to hope that no one gets hurt. But I think for that position, it's still most important to go with the starter.
Well, it is a great question because the difference between quality and depth, of course, are two different things. And Riley Leonard was great in his own right, you know, obviously in a different way than CJ Carr. CJ Carr's upside is just, you know, just too great not to choose him in terms of, you know, quality, but depth wise, certainly you had the backup 2 years ago.
CJ Carr was your fourth string quarterback, if you want to put it that way. I'm gonna go with CJ Carr because here's my differentiator. Riley Leonard, we're all intrigued about, love him. He was at Notre Dame because he couldn't go pro and the injury. CJ Carr is finishing this year off, and he's going to be a top NFL quarterback, possibly taken. So despite the clear better depth in 2024, CJ Carr, Kenny Minchie, and Steve Angeli, I mean, Carr is your fourth-string quarterback that wasn't hurt yet. So that depth isn't close, but I would still rather have fully developed CJ Carr. And boy, oh boy, are we going to get made fun of this question and answer when there's other options. Like, you had Kenny Minchie you could have thrown in the game that year. The depth is better, but I wouldn't trade it, would you?
Only if CJ Carr gets injured.
I think if your objective is to win a national championship, you can't trade it because this is the quarterback you would have
that's
to
fair,
potentially
Drew.
Do that, no. Which even though Leonard, I guess, got them close, your upside is so much higher with CJ Carr.
That's fair. Now, at running back, there's an overlap because Aeneas Williams is on both of them, a third team.
I'd rather
in
have.
One instance.
And remember, this is not in retrospect. It's going into the year. I'd still definitely rather have Love Price.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. That would
yeah,
be
definitely.
My choice as well. But depth-wise.
Come on now. Wide receiver going to
the. Yeah. I mean, wide receiver. Just we're going to, you know, look, we are going the next two Saturdays, we are about to find out just what Notre Dame has at receiver when CJ Carr is throwing the football. I'm not sure that we'll be able to accurately judge that with two young quarterbacks under pressure, live stuff.
Great Pardon point. I didn't think about that. That's a great point for these next two viewings we have. That's going to be tough to view. But very quickly to the 2024 receivers, I know I kind of laughed it off. They had a lot of guys coming in that had played football. And Notre Dame went seven deep at receiver that year. You don't think about it because they were a running team, but Jaden Thomas was their seventh most productive receiver, so they went seven deep. I think the upside depth on this is still greater than that group.
Yeah, and they're coming from, I mean, even if Mylon Graham hasn't played a ton, it's still where he's coming from and why he wasn't playing. And I was somebody who was probably unnecessarily high on a guy like Chris Mitchell, who didn't really pan out like I thought he would. But I still think I would go with 2026.
Tight end, I would go with 2024.
Agreed.
Even though he was injured, because Eli Raridan was also on the team.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I like what's happening in the tight end room now. It's look, the 2026 tight end room is just now forming.
Yes.
So, So I think you have to go with 2024. But I think in pretty short order, we could look at this a year from now, look at that position and say it's talented and it's deep.
I agree. And I think we, especially in the past game, there's a lot more confidence. I mean, we're hoping with Cooper Flanagan and maybe James Flanagan getting involved more, they'll be better in helping the run game and in short yardage situations. I don't know if my expectations are they're going to be great in the past game. Which in 2024, you knew there was potential there.
Offensive line is harder than our message board kind of pointed it out when somebody kind of said he's heard enough about the offensive line. Let's see it. And I get that. 2024 after August 2nd was when the worry started. Jagusa got hurt in early August camp. I think the 2026 line probably is deeper. It's hard to remember though, the 2024 line before that injury. Cause remember, Knapp wasn't involved. Baker was going to be a backup to Wagner. You love Schroth. You love Craig. You like
you had Cougar.
Coogan's a backup.
You had him as a backup, and you had Spindler as a backup.
Oh, Spindler was a backup too.
Right.
Man. So yeah. You don't have that kind of experience in the backup role now.
Yeah, the starter was Pendleton, which was odd.
Right.
We didn't find that odd.
Yeah, well, that was, I mean, Joe Rudolph making a long-term decision.
Yeah, I think I would probably go 2024 just because of that, but I think there's more options with, like, if somebody goes down at tackle, I think they could probably figure it out, especially once you get Craig and Jagusaw potentially back in the year, then that helps a lot, but we don't know when they're going to return. So if you're looking at what it's going to look like on September 5th or September 6th, like, I don't know if the depth will be as good as it was on day one for 2024.
Treat the secondary as one thing, guys. You want to do that?
That's how I did. And
so you have the National Defensive Player of the Year returning in Watts. You have Benjamin Morrison returning as your lead corner. You can't be fair and say Leonard Moore and Carson Hobbs are no better than Aiden Pouncey. And at this point in our lives, we had no idea that they were better than these. So I don't think you can say Leonard Moore is your backup. Now, Leonard Moore is your backup, which is kind of comical.
You had a younger, less experienced Christian Gray.
They're deeper now.
They are deeper now.
I'd rather have Shuler and Tay Johnson than Xavier Watts and what we did not know in Adon Shuler. You have to go what we didn't know. Right.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So I go secondary now.
Agreed.
The 2024 team is being unearthed and very good and very deep, by the way, as we were doing this.
And I would take that was Ben Morrison had already been injured. Like we thought he would come back. We didn't know he was going to deal with stuff again in that fall, but he wasn't healthy. I think Leonard Moore has been better up to this point in his career too than Ben Morrison too. So even that best corner, I would take this year's iteration.
Linebacker's tough because you had Kaiser and all young guys. Now all those young guys are good. Became good. So you basically remove Kaiser, add an injured-ish Barimo, injured KVA.
Yeah, you felt like the depth was better, but we didn't really know yet about Osbury.
They were all question marks, too.
Yeah.
They were question marks. So this year would be better. This, when they're healthy, this year is better.
Yeah, right. And Bowen was a question. I mean, he played more as a freshman, but it's not like – I think he got in a little bit in, like, goal line situations, but we didn't know he would be the starter he became at this time.
And to be fair, people were really bagging on the linebackers after the game number two. There was the touchdown, the 80-yard touchdown that KVA and Morrison were involved in, and then there was the wheel route on Bowen. Osbury played great, but that was a – and Snead did not play well in that game either. So I think I would go with this one. Defensive – this is tough, too. Defensive line depth is better now, right?
Yes.
You know who we haven't heard anything about, really? Keon Keeley.
Oh, that's true.
Why aren't we hearing about Keon Keeley? Why aren't we asking Charlie Partridge?
Our entire podcast, because that's going to
be. Well, I'm just no, I'm not. I'm not saying he's not making an impact, but you know, Partridge didn't maybe have reason to bring him up, and we didn't. There are times where there are questions that we just miss because there's always so much. There's so many areas. Right. And then you get, you know, like Aaron Henry starts talking, and sometimes you don't get all the questions in. I'm really, really curious to see him this Saturday because we just haven't had a lot. I'm not saying that he's not playing well. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying we haven't had a lot of feedback and commentary on him up to this point.
All right, let's be fair, Drew, because you brought this up. You start with a 2024 end situation.
Yeah, and I think going into this, I mean, Botello, we had a lot of reasons behind him. Traore was playing great. I mean, he had, you just look at what he did in the first five games of 2024. I know we aren't supposed to necessarily use how he did, but his production might have been better if you like kind of project that out over a whole season than what he did last year in 11 games. So I think, and then you have those two defensive tackles in 2024. So I think based on the quality, what we have going into the year, and we thought RJ Open would be better than he was too. He ended up not being good, but we thought he's a guy who had, I think, like 18 sacks in his career coming into that. So we actually probably need to look at him better than he was.
You know who I wish was still on the roster, and we rarely, you know, we would talk defensive ends and rarely bring his name up.
Ross Browner?
Not quite in the same on the same level. Tui Alamaka. I mean, Tui Alamaka would be great to have him as a number two defensive end or a rotating third guy or whatever.
And man, he could have been that freshman year. He was the only one of those linebackers that like got it. Remember, he played because he understood things. He understood football, and they put him in. And he talks about that once. You know, the statute of limitations might not be running. We can say this. He wanted a red shirt when he was behind Botello and Traore, logically.
Yeah.
Botello got hurt. Traore got hurt right at the time to red shirt. Junior Tua Halamaka had the game of his life against Georgia in the Sugar Bowl. Maybe we should give some credit to this third string defensive end who was awesome against Georgia in the Sugar Bowl for depth on the 2024 line. But we have a lot of high hopes for this defensive line. Cross and Mills, as it turned out, just didn't play together much. Remember, didn't play together healthy much. So great question by CMU Pens fan. I think if you look at 2024, if you want to just like project all the talent and depth of talent, you're always going to say 2026, but 2024 proved their depth was good.
Mm-hmm. Especially on the offensive line.
Yes. If we would have had a healthy, for what Mills did, which I think we could have seen, and then if Cross had played healthy and been more like he was in 2023, which we would have thought, that defensive tackle combo would have been pretty special. Which
yeah, that whole thing was that whole thing was sabotaged in the summer when Cross suffered a hamstring injury and it just lingered and
they had to get him ready because you're playing at Texas A&M. It's like
they still played 16 games that year.
Yeah. Next question. Thank you, CMU Pens fan, for you. You should contribute more. EastX903, after watching this year's Combine and Pro Day, it seems clear that Love and Pauling were the two fastest guys on last year's roster. Based strictly on your eyeball test, or I guess what you've heard, how would you rank the top five speed threats for next season for coming in here? We never would have known Pauling was the second fastest guy on Notre Dame's roster.
No, he didn't play at that speed. Drew, go ahead. You were at the Combine. I know it doesn't necessarily deal exactly with that, but
stuff. The guys I wrote down, I mean, they're all wide receivers or cornerbacks, but Jordan Faison, Mylon Graham, Christian Gray, Bubba Frazier, and Kerry Adams.
I would add, I think on a football field, and it may play out that way and he trains for it, that Leonard Moore is the fastest player.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah, I've seen him run down players as a freshman. I mean, he's the guy that caught Tyler Shook from behind so Xavier Watts could recover the fumble. I think Leonard Moore is the fastest guy on the team.
Really?
Faison Frazier. I'm a little surprised at that, Tim, but I'm not.
Well, Carson Hobbs isn't here to tell us he's the fastest anymore, so it's not Carson.
Yeah, I'm not discounting what you're saying.
I think he'd run a better 100 than he would a 40.
More?
If we're looking at there. More. Like, I think he, once he gets his top speed, he's pretty good. But I'd be really interesting what he runs and if he runs at the combine for sure.
We know Mylon Graham's really quick. How fast is he? It'll be interesting to see that. Where does Elijah Burris fit into that? Does he fit into that group?
I always think of him as quick, too. I think of him as quick.
Okay.
Yeah. I think of Faison as quick, but he's also fast. We know he's fast. He's proven fast. What about, straight line speed that you might not see would be Cam Williams.
I was going to say, I thought Cam Williams might be better in 100 than he is in a 40. I'm not really sure where I'm.
I think I can ask
deriving that
who
from
the fastest on the team is, and he will tell the truth, unlike Carson Hubbs.
Yeah, I was going to say.
The Pauling thing is really interesting because although he had after a little bit of a slow start last year, he had a really, really good season, very productive, got in the end zone. I mean, he had a real nose for the end zone, which is something that I think he proved throughout his collegiate career. But 4.37? There's no way.
He was moving, too.
And he was. When you see it, you saw it live, Drew. But when you see it, it's like, okay, well, I'm not surprised that was 4.37. I'm just surprised that was Will Pauling running a 4.37.
Right. He had run at Wisconsin. They used to release at the end of the spring, like on social media, their fastest like miles per hour runners. And he was one or two in the previous 2 years. So he did do something there. Now it's Wisconsin. How fast is that really? But
I wonder how fast Nolan James is, because he told me that he clocked at 21 miles per hour.
Osborne and Walton both said that they're super fast when we interviewed them. Like they were, I know you're a freshman and you're having fun talking to reporters and stuff like that, but they both talked about how fast they were. Like they could run right. Track. I also think Dallas Golden is a guy that when you put him on a football field, will be running down people from behind, which is what really matters. For the next 3 years is what matters on the field. I know Will Pauling made it matter on the track as well, of course, but yeah. All right. So Leonard Moore, we can ask, or we gotta have to ask a guy that's not one of the fastest. Who's the fastest on the team? Cause then someone might freely answer one of those questions. Like I think Adam Schiller might freely answer who the fastest on the team is. He's not the fastest player out there, I wouldn't think. That's an interesting question. That last year, I mean, it's not fair to say last year's team was faster because you just think of Love and Price.
Yeah.
Probably wasn't overall faster.
You're up, Drew.
Oh, yeah. Our next question is from Ostropol. On the most recent incident analysis, TP mentioned a couple of different rotating tandems, Gray and Golden, Porter and Gilbert. Excluding running back, are there any examples of successful Notre Dame tandems in the past 15 years or so who have basically shared one position?
Well, the most famous would be right tackle for the Joe Moore offensive line of 2017 was Kramer and Hainsey. Shared that position. Kramer is listed as starting all but one game. In reality, Hainsey told us that I started six games, dude. But he was just listed that way. But their snaps were almost the exact same. They played in tandem, and that was the best. I mean, they were the worst. They played in tandem because everybody else was already an all-star. But, like, that was a great tandem. The fact that they became a tandem is the best example of an O-line tandem.
Boy, it's really hard to do on the offensive line, too. That's so rare. I know that Vuliamu Asa and Bowen play the same position. They can also play alongside each other. But, you can rotate them at one position, and that's a hell of a pairing.
So, very quickly, Hainsey, 488 snaps, Kramer, 484 snaps.
Oh, wow.
Pairing, yeah.
I look at it's tough with some other positions because they can be on the field at the same time. Like Notre Dame will put three tight ends on in the field at the same time. But I like 2020, you had Michael Mayer, Tommy Tremble, and Brock Wright, all guys still playing in the NFL right now. And they did different things and they might play at the same time. But those guys were all kind of interchangeable, at least as a blocker. So,
yeah, it's like rotation is different than tandem. Kramer and Hainsey were a tandem because they didn't play together.
Right.
That's the best way I can look at it is they had to rotate in for each other. That was a true tag team. Like the linebackers work, they talk about working in tandem. When they're all healthy, they're going to have to really rotate because, Osbury, Sneed, Aremo, Bowen, and KVA. That's you're not going to play Bowen. Let's just say KVA doesn't play until, we'll be polite, say week three. You're not going to rotate Bowen and Madden Faremo as your middle linebackers exactly. He's just going to be relieving Drake Bowen. So I don't really – it's a great question of guys that are – you don't even know when they rotate. It's like, oh, Hainsey's in. Oh, Kramer's in. They just are playing in a tag team role. I don't think it happens at tight end. You just have two tight ends. Boundary is really interesting, Priester, if that happens. The Gilbert, Porter, if they're like really close in snaps over the course of – they're healthy games together. You can be close in snaps just because one was healthy and one wasn't over the course of time.
Right.
That's a great question. I can't think of another tandem that truly tagged in and out like Hainsey and, as well as Hainsey and Kramer did.
Other than running back, which is now the norm for that position to a large extent.
Is Tommy Rees coming in like 2012? Does that count as a tandem for certain moments?
Man.
Red zone?
Annoying. But it worked. I mean, it worked. That's the best. That's his best effort at quarterbacking. At quarterback coaching ever, Brian Kelly. That was amazing because he messed up a lot of quarterbacks too. Like he ruined Dane Chris at Notre Dame. But the way he got Everett Golson to be the starting quarterback and Tommy Rees to save him when needed was really impressive. He brought him in at times he just needed him to. Golson and Zaire in the Music City Bowl was a true
almost a true yes.
That was a great job by Kelly too. He lied about Golson breaking his rib, but that was still a great job by Kelly. You know that, right, Tim? Pete and I saw Golson at the airport. How's your rib? What?
What rib?
What rib? What? What are you talking about?
My rib?
Yeah. that's such good times. Sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
All right, we have a question from Terry Benedict. And that question is, one of my favorite stats involves Devin Fitzgerald's dad. He has more tackles, or he had more tackles in the NFL than he had drops. I said, no pressure, kid. No pressure on Devin Fitzgerald. I don't think that he's going to supersede his father's numbers. But what is – I'm going to have several here favorite stats since I've got about 58 years of Notre Dame football memories.
I just want to say one thing, Tim. If he supersedes his dad's numbers in college, Notre Dame is winning two of the next three national titles in the championship game 41-40 and the other one that they don't win. So that would be good times. Go ahead, Drew.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Zach Martin, he had as many holding penalties, all of, I think, which came in the run. He didn't have any in pass protection. He had 7, and that's the same number of first-team All-Pros he had. He also had 2 second-team All-Pros. But to have technically more All-Pro nods than he did holding penalties over his 11- or 12-year career is one of my favorites. And I also wrote down Frank Leahy's 39 straight games without a defeat from 1946 to 1950, and I think obviously the Rockne years get a lot of love, but Notre Dame doing it again with a second coach after the war when people really needed that type of thing to kind of get back to normalcy, and that really, I think, pushed Notre Dame to prominence. So a little bit of it is the streak, but also just, I think, what it did for the program historically.
Go ahead, Tim.
No, go ahead, if you have a follow-up on that one.
No, I asked a question.
All right, so mine, I have some negative ones that I like that are funny, and then I have a really positive one. So I find it incredible because I've done very many, many features on tight end U. And Notre Dame is clearly tight end U. If you did not read this one a long time ago, this is still going on since freshmen became eligible in 72 is when I dated it back to. Every Notre Dame starting tight end in every single year, except for Gary Godsey, who was a converted quarterback, and Dean Matzik, who blew out his knee, earned an NFL paycheck. It's the end of tight end U arguments. That's it. It's over. However, not until Michael Mayer did someone score 7 touchdowns at the position. It's the weirdest thing in the world. It's the strangest stat ever that Ken McAfee's 6 touchdowns stood through all those guys for 30 years. So that's a weird one for me. Cedric Figueroa's 7 fumble recoveries in 1986 in 11 games will never be broken, Tim Priester. You know how many he ended his career with? 7, because it's random. He had 7 fumble recoveries in 1986.
That is random. I mean, you can say you're around the football, but still.
Right. W. Ross Brown is the all-time leader, so being around the football does count, but that's still amazing. Notre Dame never averaged 40 points a game until last year, the year they did not make the playoff, and the year they did not play in a bowl game. Different circumstances, but they did not play in a bowl game, and they didn't the first time they averaged 40 a year. And my favorite bad one before I give you a good one. In 2007, Drew Mantuck, my favorite year in the history of watching bad Notre Dame football, game number 5 at Purdue was the first time they converted a 3rd and 10. I love that stat so much. Here's a good one. I told this to Jack Swarbrick courtside at the ACC championship game. Bonzi Colson, his freshman year, last 11 games, was 35 of 45 from the field as a freshman backup. Wow. 35 of 45.
Another one of those developed players by Mike Bray.
35 of 45. I'm sorry, 35 of 46. He missed a shot against Duke. Shouldn't have done that. But yeah, that's amazing for a basketball player.
I go back to 1966 when Notre Dame's defense gave up 38 points all season. They gave up 17 points in the last eight games. Six of the last eight games were shutouts. I go back to 1973 when Notre Dame averaged, you thought Lou Holtz ran the football. Notre Dame averaged 350 yards rushing per game in 73 when they won the national title. And then, I mean, Reggie Brooks, eight yards per carry in 1992. He carried 167 times, so it wasn't like light work.
He was
going
to break Gip, but he had to face Penn State's really good D in the snow. And that's what brought his total down a little bit. And he was the most famous player in the game's history.
Yeah.
Up the pass.
You know, 23 straight wins in 1988-89. Consider we were talking about number one team, number two team, number three teams that they beat. Holtz was knocking off top 10 teams right and left. A couple negative ones that I experienced growing up, 1972, Anthony Davis' six touchdowns against Notre Dame, which was a nightmare, just an absolute nightmare. And
well,
then
the second half, right? That was the 55 points in a row.
You know, he had the kick return to start the second. Did they all come in the second half? Oh, my God.
So. And then it just got worse for you?
Yeah. I was 12. You know, I was crushed. And Tony Dorsett rushing for 303 yards against Notre Dame in 1975 with Pittsburgh.
I have one more fun one. And Alan's got a better one. Alan Wasilewski has another one of these because he was doing a lot of the old stats. But Notre Dame won the national title in 1977, obviously, and they lost 25 fumbles.
What year?
1977, Notre Dame lost 25 fumbles and won the national title.
Well, I think most people, we've talked about this before, most people would be startled at the number of interceptions that the great Notre Dame quarterbacks threw in their careers. But that's the way it was. That's the way it was with
all you do is throw downfield.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like there was no fear of the turnover back then. It was pretty crazy.
Well, also option football lends itself to fumbles. That's part of it, but not that they ran the option, but teams ran the option. And everybody fumbled a lot back then. Well, that was fun. I like favorite ND stats. We should do that once every couple months in this show. But Bonzi Colson, shout out to Bonzi Colson because that is some pretty good. And by the way, I'd like to point out that was during a ACC tournament and Elite Eight run. He wasn't playing the Citadel and what do I not call Fort Wayne anymore? Fort Wayne, Indianapolis of South Bend or something like that. It wasn't against that team. Question number five, Malloy on Base, one of our favorite Twitter. I don't know if he's a subscriber or not, but he's on Twitter a lot and he likes to talk to Irish Illustrated Insider. Who do you see as being more successful in his move? Knapp to guard or Lambert to right tackle? Let's only go this year. I know they both get to play next year.
Yeah. What do you think, Drew?
I'm going with Knapp. I think it's a little, he has the more experience. I think moving inside is going to be easier for him. I think it's more natural for him too, even though I think he did well down the stretch last year. I think Lambert has a higher ceiling. I just think he's going to be playing on the edge more. I think he's going to be able to do it. He's a former soccer player. He certainly has the size and the agility, but I think just in terms of this year, I think we're going to see when Lambert makes his worst mistakes a little more easily than we are going to see with Knapp too. So I think that's going to, those things are going to stand out. And I think they both play well, but I think Knapp has an easier time transitioning to a different spot.
Totally agree. Knapp is strong pound for pound, as strong as anybody on the interior, and Lambert's going to be in space at times. And when you're in space at times, you don't always look as good. So
Lambert is now my new guy to really want to watch in the Jersey scrimmage and the blue goal game. It's not like right tackles don't try their hardest when they're matched up against someone in the blue goal game either. So that's a guy. I really liked how Lambert improved at guard last year. The whole line looked like a fish out of water at the opening game, but he started to look like, it's like, wow, he could play guard if Wagner.
No doubt. Yeah, no doubt.
So I assume he'll be.
That's got, you know what? That's going to serve him really well come NFL draft time.
Yeah, because, man, do a lot of people move to guard in the NFL. It is just a thing. And finally, one really important point on this is that Pro will probably be back next year where we can revisit this question, and then it might be a different question. Who will have a huge year, Knapp at left guard or Lambert at right tackle?
Our next question is from Tater's Dad 1. When contemplating your player rankings, do you feel that it'll be more difficult differentiating the top 22 starters than in any year in recent memory?
It's gotten harder over the years, Priester, but like last year, I pulled mine up real fast. I had Knapp 21, Faison 22, Osbury 23, Botello. So Botello's come back from injury. 24, Pauling 25, Aeneas 26. I mean, it was hard last year, too. I mean, I messed up and I had Dawson ahead of those guys. More than any other terrible mistake in there. Oh, Bryce Young, I had too high, but we all owned up to that. I think it's been very hard to do recently. I think it's going to be harder to do the top 10, as I think we broached the topic last week.
There are just so many good football players. Yeah. You know, where does Micah Gilbert fit into this? You know, we're comparing apples and oranges. How do you rank Micah Gilbert compared to Will Black? You know, right. I mean, the roles are completely different. Cooper Flanagan, a fully healthy Cooper Flanagan, the role that he plays. We haven't seen Quincy Porter. What if Luke Telich has a more extensive role as a guy coming off the edge? Nolan James, theoretically, is the number two back. Does he make the top 10? Do two running backs? Yeah. I mean,
Not with that defense.
Right. I mean, this past year, you would say that you had two running backs, obviously, in the top 10, top five maybe. But, you know, it's hard to say. Is it more difficult than last year, per se? What I do know is there's a ton of talent out here. And some of it, a lot of it's proven. Some of it isn't. And then trying to slot those guys into the top 20. Like I said, I suggested to you guys, make out your top 100 now if you have a chance, because it's a laborious task. But do it before the jersey scrimmage and the blue goal game. I think it'll help you slot better after you see those two performances.
Drew, I want to interject real fast. This was our official list, because I look at this and I'm like, I didn't have Jordan Fayes on that low. So this was our official list. And then I looked at it like, I did not have Emil Wagner number four in this whole team. So that was our official list from last year. Remember, Priester, you and I had Jagusa. We had Charles third. He finished sixth, and then he never got a chance. So the staff had Traore 10. That's probably pretty close to where he finished coming off the injury, right? I will say that staff messed up on CJ Carr. I won't. Go ahead, Drew.
Well, yeah, we can leave that buried. No, I think it'll be harder too. I also think some of the guys, like a Mylon Graham, like I think I'm really high on him, but we still haven't seen much. So I think some of the guys who are unknown, they have pretty high ceilings, and there's a lot of reasons to be high on them. That I think that makes it harder to project, in addition to the things you said. And this is just a talented deep team.
This is fun to look back at that old list. Sorry, Tim.
That's right.
Zachary too low. And I just say that because he was very close to Jadon Blair. So that was too low.
Yeah, we had no perspective on that. Not in the spring. And that'll happen. Where do you put Jagusa? I mean, where do you put him? We don't know when he comes back.
Yeah,
that's a caveat one. I mean, we can lose our minds trying to, at a certain point when we're doing this, like I'm finally like, okay, I've reworked it, and I'm not going to rework it anymore, because I'm just...
Let's start with Jagusa and put him where we would if he plays starting on October 15th and where he, if he doesn't.
Well, maybe that's probably how you have to project when he's coming. You know, how do you rate Ashton Craig? When he says he's going to be back for the opener. Will he be 100% when he does? Maybe he starts and he's not, you know, it'll take till game four for him to get up to speed. It's a good schedule to perhaps allow for that. You might be able to get away with that. I don't know. We'll find out. Question number 7 from Frozen 5. Lots of talk about technical changes. We call them improvements as fans for the defensive line. How does that manifest? Can they lead the nation in pressures or sacks, top tier against the rush instead of merely very good third down dominance? What say you guys?
Go ahead, Drew.
I think being able to get more pressure with rushing just the front four. I think they're with Chris Ash, he's always going to do probably exotic stuff and blitzes and things like that. But you don't really see, like in O'Malley, you referenced 2018 a lot, but just you had three guys with, according to Pro Football Focus, with 37 pressures or more. And Aquara had 61, Tillery had 49. I think those are the two highest marks since then, too, on the team. Include Kareem with 37. So to have three or four defensive linemen who are all up there. Last year, I think Traore led the team with 31, Bryce Young with 29. So the sacks, I think they've been around the top 20. Last year, they were 16th. So maybe they could get that up more. But I think having a few guys who can really generate pressure without them having to send four or five or six guys rushing the passer would be a major uptick for what the defensive line specifically could do.
It's a great point about the front four, or the defensive line. It won't be four guys. It could be eight guys of the front four generating pressure, because 16th in sacks, I think most Notre Dame fans don't realize they were 16th in sacks last year, especially when you're playing 12 games. Do you know who led the nation in pressures in the regular season last year? Like, not from the front four, but like the whole defense? Notre Dame.
Hmm?
Led the nation in pressures last year. The nation.
Really?
They were still ahead of Ohio State when Ohio State finished its playoff game. Indiana passed them by 4 in the championship game. Indiana played 16 games. So when you say they'd be better at pressure, let's give a little credit to Notre Dame's defensive pressure last year, since they led the nation. But it didn't all come from the front four. And as you know, when it comes to the front four, it makes that back seven officially violent and rowdy, as the words we like to use for the defense.
Yeah, and Charlie Partridge has a reputation of, he had almost 200 sacks in a four-year span with Pittsburgh, which is hard to fathom, and a lot of times it isn't bringing extra guys. Yeah, I agree with Drew. I agree with both you guys that, I think just the pass rush in general with the front four. For me, third down, Notre Dame was 35th in the country. You'd like to see a better.
Yeah.
You'd like to be, and look, we're talking about, Notre Dame's in pretty rarefied air here, so 35th is pretty pedestrian for a Notre Dame defense. That should be a top 10, top 15, top 10 stat for Notre Dame third down, especially if you're getting pressure up front, you're putting them in third and long, and you have that secondary on the back end of it, that should be pretty good. The comment was made top tier against the rush instead of merely very good. Notre Dame was 11th in the country against the rush. They were one of 11 teams that held opponents to less than 3 yards per carry. Now, maybe they beefed up against some opponents to get that average, but it was still pretty good. And I think we all feel like, that interior defensive line is better fortified now. It's larger and should hold up really well. The depth is appears to be really good there. So, the defense was so good under Al Golden and then so good under Chris Ash the last 9.5 games that you start to take some of this stuff for advantage. You know what I'm saying?
Take it for granted.
Like your stat, Tim, about pressures. People don't even realize that they were good with pressures.
Indiana finally passed him the championship game. Now, if you're an Indiana fan, say, yeah, what game do we pass you in? The championship game. Well, that makes it pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's like Notre Dame's 21 interceptions. That's fourth in the country in 12 games.
Yeah. So here's what I think we have summed up here. 21 interceptions, fourth in the country in 12 games. 8 touchdowns allowed, 2.9 yards per carry, 295 pressures in 12 games. I think they maybe should have made the playoffs is all I'm just going to say here after we listen to these things.
I don't know if they were good enough.
They didn't go for it on fourth down, though, against Stanford when they could have, and then Stanford scored. So
nobody wanted to play Notre Dame in the playoffs last year.
Sorry, Drew.
Nobody.
I was just going to add that to your point, TPA, something Coach Partridge said about Traore is last year he could set the edge. This year he's starting to see him condense it more and really push that in and create smaller or, more areas for people to come make tackles for loss too. So maybe those guys do it a little bit more there. I thought that was an interesting quote from him about what Traore is doing in the run game, which we don't always think about what he can do there.
I think we're always looking for, okay, who's the defensive end that's going to get 13 sacks? Well, I look at more and if you look at Pittsburgh stats during those times, you had a lot of guys with 6 sacks, 7 sacks, 8 sacks. There were some outliers there, of course, but what happens is you get team sacks, you start getting defensive tackles making sacks, and it's not on their own. It's because of the pressure that you're getting off the edges. So I don't care who does what individually. It's the team total. And under Charlie Partridge, he does a pretty good job of making sure the team total is among the best in the country.
And I don't mean to minimize if the linebackers get sacks. That's great. I'm just saying if they have to get your pressures, you want the front four to be able to get the pressures. So I don't. It's totally fine if Kingston Viliamuasa plays linebacker. It ends up with 29 pressures and 8 sacks. That's a great job. But I'm just saying bringing 4, that's what makes it tough on everybody. And you said who's going to get 13 sacks, Tim? I think we already mentioned him, Ross Browner or Justin Tuck. Those are the guys that get 13 sacks at Notre Dame because that's it. Next question from one of my favorites, Brokeback Brian. A pressing question for each of you on offense and defense that can reasonably be answered when you watch the Jersey scrimmage and Blue Gold game. I like that because you can't answer everything by watching that game. You're not going to know who the starting W is because we watched that game. So what's a good pressing question that we can look for in these two viewings?
First one, is Nolan James actually difficult to tackle? That would be an interesting one. But also, I think just is this offensive line one we can go into fall thinking? Because I'm a little maybe dubious that Ashton Craig could be back ready to compete for day one. So is this the line? Because I think these are the 5 most talented guys they have out there right now. is this the line that they can at least go into the season and start fall camp? And that there's a good chance, I think, seeing the cohesiveness, seeing how they're working together after, I don't know if that will be the 13th, 14th practice or whatever it will at that time. But now they've actually had time to work together since we saw them without pads on day one. What does that look like, especially against this defensive line? And then on the other end, I want to see Christian Gray at nickel going against Gray House and Mylon Graham. And what does that look like?
I don't think, like, I know a lot of people are like short yardage. I don't think we're going to get the answer to that in in the scrimmage in the blue gold game. I don't think it's fair to think that there's an answer there. It's a work in progress with Joe Otting at center. And, you know, how good is that interior defensive line? And look, no matter what happens in the blue gold game or the Jersey scrimmage, and we talk about, if one thing good happens on one side of the ball, it means something, one thing bad happened on the other side of the ball. And that's like, I don't know, the chicken and the egg argument. You know, I don't know how you determine what's good and what isn't when you know that one's going to fail in the proposition. But I agree, Nolan James. Aeneas Williams isn't going to get.
Yeah, he's not going
to. He's not going. He's going to get. But I want to see Nolan James. They should feed. He's going to get the most touches, probably of anybody back there, and really, really looking forward to that. The multiple. How many receivers can you get involved? How many of the wideouts look like they're actually pushing to have a spot in the rotation? Those would be a couple that I would start with, Tim.
I think great point on Nolan James. I actually think the Nolan James will be the highlight of our Jersey scrimmage to watch, and Jonas Walton will be the blue gold game because they probably get Nolan James out of there, and then they're going to run Jonas Walton and the two walk-ons. So Walton, that was a good answer by Pete last week, because when they gave us six freshmen, who's going to make the biggest impact? And I don't think it'll be Jonas Walton, but he might have the chance to make the greatest impact.
Yeah,
easily, because Javion Osborne won't be ready, and he only needs one injury at that point.
Yeah,
Lambert is my guy to watch now, because I want to watch Lambert go against Traore, Bryce Young, Logan Tom. I just want to see Keon Keeley, as you mentioned. I just want to see Gerby Lambert playing out there. When I watched practice number one and Keeley was killing the backup, Styles Prescott and stuff, that doesn't tell me a single thing about the season. So I want to see those guys against Will Black and Gerby Lambert on offense. Defense, there's just so much to watch, but I really hope Dallas Golden's healthy so I can see Dallas Golden and Christian Gray play nickel.
Yeah.
And he might be healthy and not play. That's the issue, because if you're at all hampered, you're not going to be in the blue gold game, right?
No, you don't want to. Yeah. When you've made it through the spring and you're getting healthier, you don't want to set back at that
point. They might want to look at him in the Jersey scrimmage. They might want to take one more look at
this. You know, every time I talk to somebody about, you know, they're going to have the scrimmage first and then the blue goal, I just hope nobody gets hurt. They're going to hit in a Jersey scrimmage, so somebody may get hurt. That's football. That's the way it happens. It's not the strength and conditioning coach's fault. If an offensive lineman gets rolled by, you know, a defensive lineman falling on him, and I can't ask Lauren Lando about that again because he'll shoot me down again for asking a question that is so ridiculous.
Payne and Diggs got hurt in blue goal games recently that I recall as guys that would have played. Payne tore his ACL.
Yeah.
For the year. Diggs hurt his shoulder. Remember, we actually kind of saw it happening there too. So it's hard to avoid, but it is a great thing for fans. So I think the blue goal game survives for a little longer. They just go. I still feel like fans would love to come watch a practice extravaganza where they go one-on-one with the receivers and corners, and there's trash talk, and there's tight, and you do that.
Oh, that would be fun. Yeah, because that's something they're not privy to that we see all the time. And it, you know, it gives you a wide variety of drills and players that are
going one on one. That'd be great. That'd be so fun for people to watch, I think. You know,
I actually think I would prefer that as well.
I would. I definitely. I think Drew's joining me on the outspoken blue goal games thing here. But I love the drill when you saw Aeneas. Remember we saw Aeneas Williams blocking and Max Bulla didn't know who he was? Bulla's like, who the hell is blocking all my linebackers? Like, that would be fun to watch. And if you could set that whole thing up where you have a very physical practice, people would be more than happy to do it. But until then, we have a question coming here from Focus and Finish. You guys say these things a lot. This is pretty good. He's a listener, apparently. First thing, remember when we first saw him flash two springs ago? He notes Jason Onyeh as an example. Well, we anointed him too early, but this is when he should break out. He notes Kevin Austin as an example, which he could have used a couple times. He flashed as a freshman, but, and he notes Jaden Mickey as an example. who are guys this spring that could fit those categories? Who's a guy that we're going to say, oh, we saw him flash in 2026, remember?
Drew, I'm going to let you start this. I mean, I want you to start this, I should say.
Okay. Yeah, the number one is the one I probably struggled with the
I
most.
Have that right? That's my one I have, so I'll
start. Okay, it. You
Bubba
go with that one.
Bubba Frazier.
Okay, nice. Yeah, I mean, I almost asked, we won't say it for the future, but Jason Onye still could be as from 2 years ago. But yeah, and Cole Mullins from 2 years ago, I went maybe more backwards. Number two, Bryce Young. I mean, I think we were talking about him as a potential All-American last year. I think this year will be the year. Maybe he's not quite at that level, but I expect him to take a big jump now that he's working with Coach Partridge. He's got his weight maybe in a slightly better place. And then number three, the third one, I went with Mark Zachary. I mean, I think he's better than Jaden Mickey, and he could certainly be the 2027 starter. But if you look at some of the talent around him, he played 307 snaps last year. He technically started three games, but I could see him getting passed up over even if Christian Gray and Leonard Moore are gone next year. I'm not sure he's going to be the starting cornerback next year. So I think he's a guy who had a really promising freshman year, but may not be a guy who's ever a full-time starter at Notre Dame.
I'm going to throw this over to you, TL, because I interpreted it differently.
So I'm not sure it took I'm going to be able to 2 years from when we first saw him.
No, I was looking at more, you know, guys now that fit that.
Oh, you could do that too. Who's your 2 years ago guy if you're doing
well, it? I don't have an exact comparison for the first one, but because, like, for example, Michael Gilbert got hurt and so he never really had the chance to do it. But Michael Gilbert was a guy that came in and it's like, I know the staff really likes this guy. I know they like his high school background, you know, and he should be prepared to, if there's a freshman receiver that's, you know, going to emerge here. And then he was injured and he was injured again last year. So that's not an exact, you know, maybe a Telich. It may have flashed then. It's like, well, he's long, he's got great range. Maybe somebody like that, but I wasn't looking at Bubba Frazier. I think is an excellent pick among the guys right now.
Yeah, I just think that if Greathouse is back and they have Greathouse and Mylon Graham that can play the slot, and you have two tight ends, and you have Jordan Faison that can flex down, and Aeneas Williams flexes out, not many snaps for Bubba Frazier. Doesn't mean he didn't have a really good spring or a good fall. He could be a really good player the next year, but that's the type for me there. We anointed him too early, but should break out. I mean, it's got to be Bryce Young. We all had Bryce Young in our, let's just say, top 15 last year. So Bryce Young is the guy that really could break out this year. And legitimately should, because he has 2 years left. This is when as you pointed out a lot, Tim, he's grown into his body. He's better off than he was at this point last year.
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, they really need him to be. Again, looking at it from the perspective I said I did, you know, we anointed Traore too early. Right. I mean, we thought yes. he was, and then he was injured.
Yeah.
And I guess he did get off to a really good start. So that's probably not even great. But I mean, I don't know that if he had all the tools or the mindset 2 years ago, you know, to be the breakout guy that, I mean, now he's got Charlie Partridge on his side. You're surrounded by a really strong supporting cast. I think Boubacar Traore is going to be a handful because of everything else that everybody's going to have to deal with up front.
The good news is it's kind of hard to find that he flashed as a freshman, but except Drew made a great point that Zachary has great players above him and below him. So that's what puts you in there. I hope it's not Elijah Burris. I'm just going to say that Elijah Burris flashed as a freshman. All we heard was about how talented he was. So I hope we're not saying next year Elijah Burris going into his junior redshirt sophomore season, he flashed as a freshman, but because he's a talented player and you know he can play, but there's competition. And if, as he mentioned, his playbook was quote unquote a mess, he meant his own mind on the playbook. So if it's not a mess anymore, I expect Elijah Burris to be Notre Dame's in the rotation when the season ends.
That's what I think that September. Yeah, that's why I wanted to say that when I mentioned earlier he was playing more free, I think you were gone for that practice. Just coming off the line of scrimmage, there's a confidence in the route that he's going to run compared to the way he came off the line of scrimmage before. Imagine being a receiver and you're coming off the snap of the ball and you're still really not sure what you're supposed to do and what your key is, what your read is.
I think that's a really good point too, because he's also – he's going to have to earn it. It's not like 2023 where he's going to get in there because they need bodies either. Like, if he's going to play, it's because he's good enough and he has all those things down. So he's not guaranteed to get on the field even because we see that he has some degree of talent.
I may never drop that conversation in 2023 in August when I said, is there enough wide receivers? Why do we need more than three? I don't know. People get hurt in football. I couldn't believe the answer. I was like, do you have enough receivers? No, you don't. That was my question. I was trying to help you out here. Yeah, that's Tim, coming up. That's so interesting. And it brings me back to what Mike Denbrock said about the passing game in 2024. And he said, we were never confident in our passing game. I think it was not only Riley Leonard. It was the whole machinery, all of it.
Yeah.
It was not a confident unit.
No, and part of it is, you know, the receivers are less confident if your quarterback's less accurate.
Yeah. And of course, I'm not absolving Riley Leonard, but I think people thought of Riley Leonard that way. But this, yeah, reps with CJ Carr and Elijah Burris. I'm stamping it now. Elijah Burris will be in the rotation by season's end when Notre Dame is in a playoff game and not in the Citrus Bowl. We'll be back on Thursday to, let's take more of your questions, because we'll be previewing the Jersey scrimmage and a few more things we're looking for. But that was fun, guys. For Tim Priester and Drew Bentock of Irish Illustrated, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thank you for watching and listening. Irish Illustrated Insider.